So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell? As y'all probably already know, these are the opening lyrics to the Pink Floyd song, Wish You Were Here. And although the biblical text was probably the farthest thing from the mind of the author who penned these words, nevertheless, they are an accurate description of the state of man post Genesis 3, a state that is repeatedly addressed throughout the narrative, and especially in the wisdom literature. Man was made to do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, but instead, he does what's right in his own eyes. And the problem is, man doesn't see things quite the way that God sees things. See, man thinks he knows better. He thinks that he can tell heaven from hell. He thinks that he can call it. But can he tell? And if not, then what is good for man to do during the few years of his life? How should he spend his time? These are the subjects that the preacher will consider in our text today. We'll be in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. But as with chapter 6, I'm not just happy to pick up with the place that the editor gave us a chapter division. We're going to get a running start into this chapter. I want to back up a few verses into Ecclesiastes chapter 6. We're going to be starting in verse 10, and I'm going to use that as a launching pad because I think those verses frame the discussion that takes place in chapter 7. So if you'll meet me in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 10. As y'all recall, Ecclesiastes is a coming-of-age tale. It's a story that a father is telling his son in order to dissuade him from seeking life through the vain philosophies of the nations rather than through the revelation of God. And the way that he goes about making his argument is through story. Okay, the father tells the son about a man who had it all, saw it all, tried it all. And the man that he tells him about, we've come to know him, he is the preacher. And through this preacher, the father is telling the son, been there, done that, waste of time. And he does that so that the son will not be persuaded to go and look for life where life cannot be found among these vain philosophies. Instead, he will choose to fear God and keep his commandments, and then therefore he will live. That's what the book is about. Pick it up with me today then, in chapter 6, verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named, and it's known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He'll spend them like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? The preacher says, whatever exists has already been named. And that's an interesting phrase, one that I've been chewing on this week. And the question I come to is, named by who? Named by who? I mean, of course, when we think of the Genesis narrative, and I think of man and his original place to be God's physical representative on the earth, I think of the delegation of authority that was given to him, that he was able to name the beasts. The Lord would parade the beast before him, and whatever man called him, that was his name. I also think about the man naming the woman and naming his wife. He calls her life in expectation of the future life that's coming through her because of the seed of the woman that is in her, the one who's going to remove the curse and fix our problems and bring us back into the garden. I think about that. But when it came to the light, when it came to the darkness, when it came to the sea and the land, and all of the other aspects of creation, man did not name those things. And in truth, because of the discussion that follows, I don't really think we're talking about naming in this passage as much as we are ascribing value to something. What is tov? What is good, beautiful, right? As opposed to what is evil or bad or ugly, wise, opposing to what is foolish. And I think that what we see here, if you look at it in verse 10, man clearly holds a different opinion from God. His problem is he's not strong enough to dispute with it. God's the boss. He's called it. Man disagrees, but he can't do anything about it. And that dispute, I believe, relates to verse 12. Who knows what is good for man? Who can tell what a man should spend his life doing? Do you think you can tell? Well, he's going to tell us what's good in the following verses. Let's see how you do. Notice it, verse 1 of chapter 7. A good name is better than good ointment. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Because that's the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter. For when a face is sad, a heart might be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. It's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool, and this too is futility. For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of the matter is better than its beginning. What is good for man? Well, if you were thinking death and funerals, sad faces and rebukes, well, then congratulations, you're of one mind with the preacher. But for the rest of us, we're going to have to unpack this a little bit and say, what are we talking about? Connect the dots for me. Why is this what's good? Does not seem intuitive to me. I would think that a party is better than a funeral. I would think that laughing is more fun than having somebody chew me out for my foolishness. Tell me, preacher. Well, he says, a good name is better than a good ointment. Now, we've all had this experience before. I have it all the time because I live in an apartment complex in Dallas. So my path covers the same steps that a lot of other people's path covers every day. And I'll often have the experience where I'll be coming back from dropping the kids off at school or coming home from the library, and I'll pass somebody who is wearing, you know, a guy or a gal with an expensive cologne or perfume, you know, the good stuff, not the cheap stuff, the good stuff. And they will leave a corridor of perfume. I'll know everywhere they went. As long as I'm walking in their steps, I know they've been there because that perfume lingers. And it goes into the elevator, the whole deal. So you know where they've been, but the place is better for it. You know, it is endearing. It is the kind of thing, if you're wearing a good ointment, you're the kind of person that people want to be around. Okay? You have a sweet smelling aroma about you. A good ointment's good, but a good name, a good reputation, well, that's better. It lasts a lot longer, okay, than the best perfume. And I think we'd all agree with that. That seems intuitive. But then he says, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. What? Now, what's he talking about? Day of one's death better than that. Where did that even come from? Is he depressed? Is he getting nihilistic? You know, is he saying the whole thing's a waste of time? Why would the day of one's death be better than the day of one's birth? I think of King Hezekiah. Y'all remember the story of King Hezekiah? He's king of Judah. He was Ahaz's son. We read all about it in the book of Isaiah. And at the opening chapters of Isaiah, when you come to Isaiah 6, we run into Ahaz, his pops. And Ahaz has a problem. Israel, the northern kingdom, he's king of the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom has made a partnership with Aram, and they're going to come and go to war with him. So what he does, you know, Isaiah comes to him and says, don't worry, you're a king from the line of David. The Lord's got this. You just need to trust in God. Say amen. If you say it'll stand, you'll stand. He doesn't. He says, I'm not going to test the Lord like that. Far be it from me. And what he's really doing is not because he's pious. It's because he's already made a covenant with Assyria. He's made a deal with the big kid on the playground. Assyria saves. Assyria is the one that's going to protect him. And so he gets his whole nation in big trouble because Assyria comes in. It does protect him from the northern kingdom. It exiles Israel. And it protects him from Aram, but what we find is in Hezekiah's lifetime, now Assyria is coming for them too. And they take everything. He gets walled in up to Jerusalem. They've taken all the rest of their land. We got Sennacherib, this commander, who's laying a siege against the city. And here comes Isaiah again, whose name means Yahweh saves. How about it, Hezekiah? And Hezekiah calls him up and says, I know Yahweh saves. And the Lord does end up delivering Hezekiah. He gives Jerusalem a stay of execution. But Hezekiah's story does not end there. See, he gets ill. He gets sick to the point of death. And it looks like it's going to be curtains for him. In fact, some of you might know, when we've talked about the Foley family a little bit, some of us have. We have a Foley family have a motto. And our motto is Ut Prossim Deo. It's a play on an older Foley motto, Ut Prossim, which means that I may be of use. You know, this is Latin. That I may be of service. But it's that I may be of benefit to God. Ut Prossim Deo. And it actually comes from this story of Hezekiah. See, he becomes ill. Lord sends Isaiah to him and says, Hezekiah, you're going to the grave. But he prays to the Lord. He says, no, Lord, don't let it happen. Lord sends Hezekiah right back and says, guess what? God's going to give you 15 more years of life. 15 more years. But you know what he does in those 15 years? Listen to what the chronicler has to say about this. This is 2 Chronicles 32, verse 24 and 25. In those days, Hezekiah became mortally ill. He prayed to the Lord. The Lord spoke to him, gave him a sign. But Hezekiah gave no return for the benefit he received, because his heart was proud, and therefore wrath came on him and on Judah and on Jerusalem. See, the Lord granted him those 15 more years, but Hezekiah used those 15 years to ruin his name. He offered no good return for the benefit that he received. That's why we say, be a benefit to God. Offer return for all the good we've received in Christ Jesus. Hezekiah offered no return. He used the time to destroy his legacy. He put Jerusalem in the crosshairs of Babylon by showing off the treasury. And he fathered Manasseh, and obviously did not teach him any wisdom, because Manasseh became the worst king in the history of the southern kingdom. I mean, he was 10 times worse than the worst king before him. So he ruined everything. So at the end of the day, I think of Hezekiah, he would have been much better off if he'd have just died. Just died. You had a good run, Hezekiah. Call it there. I think of more contemporary examples. Examples that I have looked up to, like Ravi Zacharias. We've talked about him before, and many like him. He had a great name. It was ruined through sexual misconduct. His books are now removed from the shelf. His ministry, Arzim, was an apologetics ministry. They don't do that anymore. They turned into a charity now. Everything he touched turned to ash. It would have been much better for him to have died rather than to have lived and do the things that he did that destroyed his name, his legacy. See, the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth, because when you're born, you have everything to lose and a lifetime to screw things up. Once you're dead, the book is closed on your story. You can't do anything else to harm your neck. You've done all the damage you can do in the short years of your life. That's sealed. That's why. That's the connection. So I think about that. A good name is beneficial, and that's why one's death is better than one's birth. With that in mind, would you rather go to a funeral or a wedding? Well, weddings offer cake, and cake is good, but funerals offer perspective, and that's better. That's better, because we're all headed that way. We don't want to be surprised when we get there. We don't want the final judgment to be the first time that we've thought about our final destination. So it's good for the living to be somewhere where he might consider things that actually matter, that actually profit in this life. And to that end, verse 3, he'll say, sorrow is better than laughter. Why? Can you tell a smile from a veil? See, someone might be putting on a show. They may be pretending to be happy when they're actually quite the opposite. You know, their Facebook might look good. Their Instagram might look like they have the best life ever. But in reality, they are miserable. And you just would never know it. You know, some dance to remember, some dance to forget. That's Hotel California. That's what this world has to offer. The house of pleasure, the house of feasting. That's a house to keep you occupied so that you don't think of all the troubles that are plaguing your life. They may laugh on the outside, inside their heart might be sad. But why might someone have a sad face and their heart be happy? Well, maybe it's because they're at a house of mourning. Y'all remember Dr. Bayless, who has been such a blessing to the building up of this body, who recently died. All right, considering the death of a godly loved one, we may grieve, but we don't grieve as those who have no hope. I may have a sad face, but I'm happy for him. It may be that what you see on the outside isn't the end of the story, as with the laughing person who may be sad. So the wise man has his mind on the house of mourning. He numbers his days. He remembers that God will bring every act to judgment. And to that end, verse 5, it is better then to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. A stern rebuke, getting chewed out, is better than getting serenaded. Why? Because that might just save you from yourself. It challenges you so that you might correct your path before it's too late. I think of Proverbs 27, 5 and 6. Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. See, the enemy, the music that he's playing, verse 7, is like a bribe that corrupts the heart. When I think of things that youth don't understand in their youth, this is somewhere near the top of the list. I recently saw a story. A teacher had gotten into big trouble because he was berating his students. He was wearing them out. He was trying to tell them that the path that they were on is leading to an end that they don't want to end up at. You don't want to go there. So he's wearing them out. They have an opportunity right now to make a life for themselves, to set their future. And they're wasting it. So he's trying to tell them they're being foolish. And of course, the students thought that he was, you know, since he was rebuking them, he must be being hateful to them. He hates them because he says these things that they don't like to hear. He's being bigoted towards the students. And so they go and tell their parents about it. The parents bought it. The media ran with it. And this teacher is getting in big trouble. But it was clear to anyone who had ears to hear and was listening to the story that the teacher did not hate his students. All right, if he hated his students, then he would have just been phoning things in. He could go in, punch the clock, pull a paycheck, let them do whatever foolish thing they're doing, and it's not really his job to make them. If they don't want to listen, they want to play on their phones or whatever, that's their decision. He's not taking their tests for them. He could go in, punch the clock, if he hated them. And that's what he would have done. Just like everybody else in their lives. Just like their parents. Just like their foolish friends. Who do not care enough about them to rebuke them. To point them in the wise way. The preacher says there's profit in a harsh word. But laughter? Where's the profit in that? It's empty calories, man. That's like cotton candy. What good is it? It's vanity. It's futile. It doesn't give you anything. At the end of the day, he says the end is better than the beginning, just as death is better than birth. So it would be good for man to dwell on it just a little bit. You know, if we can keep up with our sports teams, if we can keep up with whatever craziness is going on in politics or whatever other, we might want to at least spend a little time dwelling on where we're going. All of these other things are going to come and go like a vapor, but we'll all end up at this place and we're going to be there a long time, like forever. So we probably should think about that. Verse 8. The end of the matter is better than the beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it's not from wisdom that you ask about this. Wisdom, along with an inheritance, is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection, as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. Consider the work of God. Who's able to straighten what he's bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider. God's made one as well as the other, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. In light of the end, he says it is better to be patient than haughty. Really, it is the word is long of spirit rather than tall of spirit. It's rather to be long of spirit. It's better to be thick skin, not to take yourself too seriously, not to get angry over nothing. That's what fools do. Will Smith at the Oscars. Need I say more? The man has ruined his entire career. For what? How often do our actions done impulsively tend to overshadow the offense that spurred it? You know, it eclipses it so that no one even remembers the offense. They're talking about the crazy thing we did in response. Fools feel like they have to always defend their reputation. It's always now. Every hill is a hill to die on. But as for wisdom, verse 19, wisdom strengthens a man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. You don't have to worry about being besieged by this or that, by this word or that word, verse 21, which is why he'll say, don't take seriously all words which are spoken, so that you won't hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. You're guilty of this too. Let it pass. These last verses as well, if I'm looking at verse 10 and onward, they seem to go together to me. Where has the preacher been focusing the son's attention thus far, all the way through? He does the same thing that Solomon does in the Proverbs. Nancy and I were talking about this on one Wednesday night. All right, you got this son, this naive one, this empty-headed one, and you got everybody's vying for his attention. The adulterous woman, his stupid friends, they're trying to pull him, to draw him this way, to tell him what's good. And they're appealing to his senses, what you see and taste and touch. And what's good seems to be what will benefit him now. Like right now. The adulterous woman will benefit you right now. Robbing somebody, taking their money, benefits you right now. And the father and the mother are giving him wisdom. And they're saying, no. It's not best life now, son. You need to consider the end. Where is life? Life is not right now. Life is coming. You need to consider the end. You go with those friends, it will not go well for you in the end. Same thing here. The preacher in our text has been considering the end. He's been pointing the son to the end of things. And so he says, do not dwell on the past. Don't get nostalgic and look back. You need to look forward. Look where you're going. I think it's a perennial feeling. Every generation has felt this way, that things were just better. You know, things were better when we were growing up than they are now, and now everything's going to hell in a handbasket. It's been going to hell for a long time, since Genesis 3. And we're waiting for the kingdom. But every generation has that feeling, and the preacher saying, you do not know what you are talking about. There is no wisdom in that statement. Why? Because your life is fleeting. You do not even have the perspective to make a better or worse judgment on this. Better than what? Better than this little, history has gone on for a long time. You're here. So you're arguing that this little speck is better in relation to this speck rather than the enormous amount of time that's come before? Well, of course you can't say anything about that. Because he's going to say, we can't discover that in just a moment. That it's mysterious to us. Verse 24, what has been is remote. It's exceedingly deep. Who can discover that? God knows those things. We don't know those. I take various classes at school that are trying to help build cultural context so that I can have a more accurate interpretation of the biblical text. So we look to places that people are digging up pots from the ground. And as though that's going to... we make all kinds of speculations. It's like Dr. Klingler likes to compare it to Little Mermaid. You know that scene with the seagull, and he's trying to explain to Ariel what all these human artifacts are. So he'll pull out a pipe and say, it's a dingle hopper. He said, what do you use these dingle hoppers for? Well, the humans use it to make all kind of music, you see. And he tries to blow in it, and the tobacco's all stuffed in there. That's what we do. We have little to no knowledge about the past. We are so finite. So the preacher here says, don't think that you have the ability to consider that. It's a waste of time. Don't get too nostalgic. You need to be looking forward. You need to be looking at the end. And don't we all look at the past with rose-colored glasses anyway? I mean, I can't have conversations with my friends about a fishing trip that we took without them telling tall tales. You know, that fish that was here came to here, and now it's here. I said, I was there too. I remember that fish. It wasn't here. We're finite beings, and the preacher says, it's foolish to go down that road. Wisdom is, however, and my New American Standard renders this in verse 12, a protection, as money is a protection. I really don't think that's the best way of rendering the word. The word is really talking about a shadow. Wisdom is a shadow as money is a shadow. So it is providing protection. Protection from the sun. But really what we're talking about is comfort. It provides a level of comfort for someone. All right, I think that's what the point is here. Wisdom and money can provide a degree of comfort, but without wisdom, money is just palliative care. Wisdom has the advantage of preserving the life of its possessors. Money does not. It would just be palliative care. So seek wisdom. And the one thing that he wants to make clear about that then is the wisdom of outcomes. See, God has made the day of prosperity, he will say, and the day of adversity. And why does that matter, preacher? Because you need to realize that he's not distributing it on the basis of righteousness or wickedness. If somebody's walking around and their numbers in their bank account are going up, that is not necessarily an indication that God is blessing them or blessing their business or whatever. Just as if somebody is poor or sick, that is no indication that God is cursing them or that they're under his wrath. We'll see that problem pop up all the times in the New Testament. Paul's having to explain, look, believers aren't under the wrath of God. We're in jail because you guys keep attacking us. If you'd stop hitting us, then we wouldn't be getting beaten, would we? It's not that God is distributing prosperity and adversity because he is partial. It has nothing to do with the books on your shelf because you're wise. It has nothing to do with the money in your bank account. The reason he does it, verse 14, is so that no one will be able to discover anything that will be after him. So that I can't look at my neighbor across the street and judge by the car in his garage or whatever else he's got going on, whether or not he's headed in the right direction in the end. God is bribing the people that are on his team and Satan's team is just getting cursed out the wazoo. It's so that I can't discover that. I have no knowledge on it based on my surroundings. It's not what I can look and see or hear. Not, my senses don't tell me. I need revelation for that. God's going to have to tell me how to be pleasing to him. He's not in the bribery business. Notice what he's going to say about this. Verse 15. I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. There's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Don't be excessively righteous and don't be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Don't be excessively wicked. Don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It's good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Don't be excessively righteous. What's he talking about? You know, keep a little bit, mix a little bit of that wickedness in there. He's talking about karma. He's talking about karma, which is a pagan belief built on the account of this blessings and curses in Israel. I mean, it's a pagan, it's not built on that, excuse me. It's a pagan belief out there in the pagan religions, but because of the blessings and curses, you'll find it in Israel too. They struggle with this too, because if they are in the land and they are keeping covenant, then God causes their crops to grow and rain to fall and all that stuff. And that's what confuses them when they come to the New Testament. Even believers, you read the book of James, the problem between the rich and the poor. Because they're making distinctions, they're becoming partial and saying, hey, you rich guy, come sit in the front. Poor guy, you go to the back. Because this is obviously a demonstration of who God is pleased with and who he's not. It's Jewish karma. Christians, we do the same kind of junk. He's saying, that's a waste of time. That is completely false belief. He says, I know people think that if you're a good boy, God's going to reward you with stuff, and if you're a bad boy, they'll take your stuff away. But let me tell you, it does not always work out like that. Believe me, I've seen it. A righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and a wicked man who flourishes in wickedness. And the word that he uses here, he says in verse 16, the NASB translates it as a ruin. It's really astonished. It is confounded, dismayed. You know, he's basically saying, don't think that your righteousness or wisdom will guarantee God's blessing in your life in a physical way that you can measure. Because you might find out that it doesn't go that way. And then you're going to be confused. You're going to be astounded. But I did all this. You're going to be Job sitting over here with friends coming, saying this junk to you. Well, you know, God must be hitting you. I know you got sin somewhere. Now, they're astounded. They're confounded. Because they don't think that's how the world works. He says, believe me, it's not like that. But he's also not giving them license to sin. Notice verse 17. You go down that route, God just might take you out the game early. You might die before your time. So don't depend on your own righteousness as though that's a guarantee things will go well for you. Don't live a wanton lifestyle. He's not saying be double-minded. He's not saying mix wisdom and folly. He's not saying live like a lukewarm Laodicean church. Even though, verse 20, he will say, there's not a righteous man on earth who never sins. He's not advocating for sin. He's advocating what? Live in light of the end. The coming judgment. God might not reward in this life, but he will reward. God might not punish in this life, but he will punish. So the reason we need wisdom, I think of what the preacher is saying here, it's exactly because we need righteousness. We don't got it. We all sin. Our righteousness will not be enough at the time of judgment. No one continually does right, which is demonstrable by our propensity, verse 22, to curse others. I can't get along with my neighbor. So in light of the judgment, we need wisdom. And the beginning of wisdom is... yeah, fear the Lord, which is what the Father tells the Son. Remember, fear God, keep His commandments, because we're all coming before the throne. Forget the philosophies of the nations. It's bunk. Verse 23. I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I'll be wise. But it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly deep. Who can discover it? Wisdom has limits. You know, that's the point. Man can't tell what's good for him during this short life. We don't know nearly as much about the past as we think we do. We have no access to the future whatsoever. So we have to trust in what is revealed. You got to go to the one who knows. Fortunately for the son, he lives in a place that has a relationship with the one who knows. So he needs to spend time considering that and consider the end of every man. Verse 25. I directed my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. And I discovered, more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Behold, I have discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation, which I am still seeking, but have not found. I found one man among a thousand, but I have not found a woman among all these. My wife's been studying Ecclesiastes at some point. She asked me about that verse. I said, you know what that means. You know. The men know. No. So one reason here, we've spoken about the whole issue of the book before. The father teaching the son. Who is the father? Is he the same as the preacher? Many take the preacher as being Solomon. And I think that the preacher is, he's never named as Solomon, but boy, does he have a lot of the same resume descriptions as Solomon has. You know, he's the wisest man that ever was. He's a king over in Israel. He's got wealth. He's married to a lot of women. I think about that, and this is actually one of the reasons why I think that Solomon did not write this. Because I think that the father is using him particularly to be that image, that character that the son's to think about. And he needs to think about Solomon's end. about Solomon's problem. What was Solomon's problem in the story? Think of 1 Kings 11. Why on earth did the kingdom split? Solomon had many wives, many foreign wives. He marrying the daughter of the king of Egypt and on. And they end up drawing his heart away from the Lord to serve other gods. They became a big problem for him and for the nation for the rest of the story. Because when Solomon tried to please them and was giving opportunity to worship these other gods, that caused the Lord to be jealous. So he took the kingdom away. It split and it never recovered. We anticipate a recovering. And Ezekiel 37 says that the two sticks, they're coming back together, but they haven't come back together yet. Judah and Israel never came back. So I think about that. I think about what the father is saying here. And I think he's pointing his son back to the life of this one who had it all, tried it all, and it came to nothing. He went after all of this, and he didn't find it, and it caused big trouble for him. Also, I think of the description here. This is interesting. Verse 26. He's talking about the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. It's interesting. Who escapes and who's trapped? I mean, are gentlemen who love the Lord any less prone to making poor decisions in infidelity and whatever than sinners? And we just talked about Ravi. I think not. What's interesting about this is we looked a couple weeks ago. We're on the other side. We're talking about how Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, the two sides. We're looking at the positive instruction from the father and mother, from the wisdom of God, and then the negative side in Ecclesiastes from the wisdom of the nations, the philosophies of the nations. But we're looking at the wisdom of God. Wisdom is contrasted with folly, and both of them are women. You know, you got woman wisdom who's calling out to the naive, come in, I'll build you up. And you got woman folly, you know, she's hiding over in the corners under the cover of night trying to draw in people with her aromas and her, you know, her wily ways so that she can deceive them, so she can trap them, so that she can destroy them. And it's the sinners, of course, who are destroyed by folly. So I think it's better to think of the background there, not just as, okay, well, there are some women out there who can be a problem for you. No. I think we're talking about folly. It's a problem. And then on the converse side, it's consider the outcome of Solomon. It didn't go well for him. He tried that, didn't work. So I think about this, the problem with man, ultimately verse 29, behold, I found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. He made man upright, but we have made ourselves bent. We have talked about the word iniquity before. Every man has scoliosis. All right, iniquity is bending the line. I think of sin, I'm outside the line, outside the circle. I think of transgression, I'm initially crossing the line, but I think of iniquity as a blurring of the line. We're bent. We are bent people. We've sought our own devices. It's a problem for all of us because we have a fallen character, which is exactly the thing that causes us to need the revelation of God, because we don't know the wisdom of God. God's wisdom comes from His character. It's a value statement, just like right and wrong, good and evil, beauty and ugly. Wise as opposed to what? Who gets to call it? Based on whose character and whose will and whose desires. But man doesn't see things like God. And that's his problem. So who gets to determine what is good for man? What's the right steps? What should be thought about during his lifetime? What about us? Can we tell heaven from hell? Or do we also need help? In light of what the preacher has to say, I consider this wisdom here. I consider the perspective of man, limited as it may be, in contrast to our Lord. I consider the end that we all have to face. And I say, so what should we do? Well, we live in the present, but we're looking in the future. We're stuck in the meantime. The Christian life, we have passed from death unto life, but it's a life that is future. We are living in the now time in expectation of the future. We're about to celebrate Easter next week. That's what this whole thing is about. Resurrection. Resurrection is a future event for the believer based on a past event from our Lord, but it gives us power in the present, knowing what's coming in the future. You say, how so? I say what Paul says in Philippians. It's called resurrection power. He says, I haven't obtained the resurrection, but I'm looking for it, that I may know the power of his sufferings and his resurrection. What is resurrection power? It's the power to suffer in the present as we anticipate the certain joy that we will have in the future. We can even suffer into death. Why? Because he's just going to bring us back in the kingdom. It's resurrection power. It's the power of perspective when man looks to the end in faith, trusting the wisdom of God rather than the foolishness of man. That's what the preacher is on about. That's what the Father wants his Son to receive in chapter 7.